the week of September 12th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 71, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Amsterdam, Holland, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And always in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at the Bell Lightbox, the brand new center of the Toronto International Film Festival, I'm Michael Giltz.
How is Toronto going there, Michael?
Well, it's a transition year, so everything's a bit hectic and crazy. But we'll get to that when we talk about the film festival proper. But I'm tired, so it's a film festival.
I'm exhausted. I've been attending the International Broadcasters Convention all week. It's probably one of the biggest conventions they've had in recent memory. Close to 75,000 people cramming 13 huge exhibition halls. But we probably won't be talking too much about that. We are going to be talking about Toronto, the film festival, of course, as Michael just mentioned. We'll also be talking about the MTV Video Music Awards. I am praying somebody saw them.
Better be Karen.
No.
You didn't?
No.
You had Chelsea Handler in it. I was sure you would watch it.
I can't stand her.
I know.
Why would I devote 2 hours to watching Chelsea Handler if I can't stand her in half an hour?
So you could mock her.
No. I had North and South book 2 to watch.
Really? Miniseries?
Yes.
What was that, Lifetime?
I own it. I watched it, book 1 over Labor Day weekend, and book 2 was last weekend, and book 3 will have to be next.
And ladies and gentlemen, this is what you get when you have 3 hosts in 3 different world time zones.
Do you now refer to it as the war between the states?
Yes, I do. Yes, the war between the states.
The war of northern aggression. All right, let's move on. Sorry.
So as you can see, we are semi-prepared for today's episode. We're going to try and do Big Deal or Big Whoop, but we've been traveling around so much, it's going to be kind of haphazard. Bear with us. But of course, first, as always, we will turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and, of course, film festival attendee, Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Yes, which I did not contribute to, even though I've seen like 30 movies in the last 5 days. The number one movie at the box office was Resident Evil Afterlife, the latest in the Resident Evil franchise. It grossed $27.7 million, a very strong opening for the movie. And that was by far the biggest news at the box office. Way down at number two was Takers with $6.1 million. That's at $48 million total, so that's definitely a hit for them. And number three is the George Clooney drama The American, which grossed just under $6 million, and it's at $26 million total. And since the movie cost $20 million to make, that's a win too. And number four is Machete, the Robert Rodriguez film with Lindsay Lohan's comeback. That grossed $4.2 million. That's at $20 million total, and that had a $20 million budget. And at number five, the Drew Barrymore, Justin Long romantic comedy, Going the Distance, which grossed $3.8 million and is now at $14 million total. The rest of the top 10 all made between $2.9 and $3.6 million, just about $3 million. The other guys, Will Ferrell comedy, that was at $112 million total. The Last Exorcism is still chugging along. That's at $38 million total. The Expendables is at $98 million. So Sylvester Stallone will hit $100 million sometime this week. Inception is at $282 million. And Eat, Pray, Love, the Julie Roberts film, is almost done at $74 million. I didn't get to the movies. Did you guys?
Get to the movies? I've been speaking at a conference all week.
Get to the movies. I've been watching North and South, book 2.
I'm not going to get into the fact that you were watching a DVD instead of watching the MTV Video Music Awards, but we will talk about that later. I'm looking here on the box office, and I'm seeing that The Last Exorcism cost $1.8 million to make and has made $38 million. Is that correct?
Sure. It's a low-budget mock documentary about an exorcism with no-name stars. Yeah, it was a very, very small-budget film. You know, it's as much a winner as the higher grossing Paranormal Activities. But yeah, you pay $1.8 million to make a movie, you gross $40 million, and that doesn't even count overseas. So that's a huge, huge hit. I bet there'll be a Laster exorcism coming down the road.
Laster?
Well, I couldn't think. It's supposed to be the last, but...
The Lastest exorcism.
Oh, it'll be
good
a prequel.
Good for Lionsgate.
It'll be a prequel to be the next to last exorcism. Yeah, no, people are making money without, you know, that's the old story. Like, oh, we don't need stars anymore. It's silly, but you can make money off movies without any names.
Yeah, but with everything they're going through, it's nice to see that their movies are doing well.
Well, Karen, what you're referring to is that Carl Icahn, the investment magnate, is trying to take over Lionsgate, and he's now, I think, offered $7.50 a share. I guess having a huge hit where you pay $2 million to make a film, maybe another $2 million to market it, and then wind up earning $38 million, that might keep him at bay a little.
Well, they certainly spent more than $2 million to market it, and but it's a hit, and The Expendables is there as well, the Sylvester Stallone flick.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's been a good couple of months for them, and it was a really good week for Screen Gems.
They have the number one and the number two films, Resident Evil and Takers.
Yes, well, and Takers has made $48 million. Not bad.
No, it's a $32 million budget, but that's definitely in the win column, especially since it was cheated out of the number one slot for a day or two until we realized it was the rightful heir. So it's been a number one hit film. That's always good to put on the DVD.
And Paul Walker's in that, right? A poor guy who can't seem to get a job.
Well, he can't seem to act either, so that might
that's
be
the problem.
The
that's reason. The problem. It reminds me so much of this guy I dated in college. It's like, it's uncanny. Anyway, okay, Michael, tell us about Toronto.
I'm at Toronto Film Festival. It's a very much a transition year. They moved their headquarters from last year to this year, and in the middle of the festival, they've opened their brand new space called Bell Lightbox. So it's a grand new space with, I'm not even sure how many screening rooms, I think five. It's lavish. It's lovely. Ivan Reitman and his family donated $20 million to the project. It's been 10 years in the making. So Ghostbusters really helped build Lightbox. And it's a lovely facility. It'll be great to see how it'll pan out in the years to come. But right now, it's sort of a little hectic. Everybody's all over the place. A lot of the movies are at this multiplex right around the corner. So it's a lot more centered and focused than it was in years past. It used to be there were screening rooms 4 or 5 or 8 or 10 blocks scattered around town. Now they're all in basically one or two buildings that are within a block or two of each other. So that's really nice. But the big news for me at the festival is that I have shown an uncanny ability to avoid any movie that gets good reviews.
Really?
I have missed 127 Hours. I have missed The King's Speech, which everybody is touting as an Oscar potential for Colin Firth. I even read a biography of King George VI to prepare for it. I have not seen all of Super, which was the first film at the fest to get picked up. It's a superhero movie starring Rainn Wilson of The Office. I have yet to see The Conspirator, the Robert Redford film about the plot to assassinate Lincoln, for which I read two books to prepare. So my story at the festival is really, I haven't seen a lot of good movies.
What's 127 Hours?
127 Hours is the James Franco film directed by Danny Boyle. It's the true story of a mountain climber who gets trapped on the side of a mountain.
The guy who cut his arm off.
Yes, that is correct.
His arm. And people who've seen it love it. They say it's just, they love it. It's great. It's gripping. Yes, it's unbearable, but somehow you can do it and watch it. And it's not torture. It's just really fascinating and great. I can't wait to see it. James Franco is definitely the it boy of the fest in a way.
Well, it's kind of like his year this year, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's getting his postgraduate degree, I don't know. But he had a short film at Cannes. He has Howl, the Allen Ginsberg film, opening up. He's in ads. He's on General Hospital. He's everywhere. So good for him. I like him a lot. I think he's really talented. He's on the cover of The Advocate also this week, which is a gay magazine, which is almost dead. But it was good to see him on there talking about all the movies and all the gay roles he's played and why he finds them so challenging and interesting.
You didn't see 127 Hours. You were really waiting to see The King's Speech, which apparently, as you said, gets great reviews. Is somewhere showing there? I know it showed at Venice, but is it showing in Toronto?
They might have had a quick screening right at the beginning. I'm not sure. It's not on the press list, so it's not playing here, I don't believe. They might have had some public screening I don't know about, but no, I didn't have a chance to see the Sofia Coppola film, which won the top prize at Venice, which of course people are saying, oh my God, the jury had Quentin Tarantino helped get movies to his friends, you know, awards to his friends' films. Well, duh, that happens at every festival ever made, you know. An actor, head of the jury, gives the prize to their favorite director. Directors give prizes to their favorite actors. It happens all the time.
Didn't that happen in Cannes a couple years ago when we were there, the White Ribbon one?
Yeah, well, Isabelle Huppert was the head of the jury, and Michael Haneke, the director, had directed her in one of her great performances, The Piano Teacher. The year she was head of the jury, he won top prize for White Ribbon. It's also an incredibly well-received film, especially by the Europeans. I didn't like it, but a lot of people did. So, you know.
Yeah, but didn't the one that Tarantino, the ones that won awards were not considered to be very good?
Yeah, but that happens too. The jury is crazy. You know, the jury's like five or six people. They're not there to reflect the critical consensus. So you never know what a jury is going to do. And they like their friends. So it happens all the time.
Well, Quentin Tarantino was the head of the jury at the Venice Film Festival, the 67th version of that film festival. It's the oldest film festival in the world. And Sofia Coppola's film Somewhere, about a hard-living Hollywood actor who re-examines his life after his 11-year-old daughter surprises him with a visit, and I guess they're staying at the Chateau Marmont. That won the festival.
That's where I always take my kids, the Chateau Marmont.
Yeah, well, I just like hearing you guys say it that way, instead of Marmont.
Yeah. Marmont, thank you.
So now, despite the fact that you didn't see any of the good movies, as you say, what movies have you seen, and were they any good?
Well, I have seen some good movies. My favorite film of the fest so far is The Illusionist, an animated film by the director of The Triplets of Belleville, which I loved. And this is based on a screenplay by the late Jacques Tati, the French brilliant comedian. And it's just a charming, bittersweet tale. I was sort of watching it and liking it, liking it. And suddenly at the end, I felt very emotional. It was a very moving, touching, bittersweet little film. But that debuted somewhere else, so I don't really consider it a find for Toronto. But it's definitely a good movie. And then I think the big news of the fest is the flowering even more of one of their top venues, which is Midnight Madness, which is a segment programmed by Colin Geddes. And Midnight Madness is always popular. It always sells out. It takes place at a slightly different venue at midnight, of course, every night, and is just crazy. There's like hundreds and hundreds of people line up for hours in advance to see the movies. They cheer everything. It's the most supportive audience in the world. And this year, they had 9 out of their 10 movies are world premieres, which is a record for Midnight Madness. It launched Super, the Rainn Wilson film, which was the first film of the fest to get a distribution deal. And it just feels like it's really at the heart of things in a way that is really fun to see. It's a favorite program because when you've seen a lot of hard, difficult, heavy movies, it's great to go to Midnight Madness and see some crazy, nutty film, you know, about a horror film or sci-fi or busty babes and just have a good time with an audience that's there to have fun.
Well, now, didn't Sony Picture Classics pick up Super?
I thought it was IFC, but I'm, you know, my head is spinning. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, I know that Sony Picture Classics picked up Barney's Version before the festival even started.
Yes, that's a film based on the Canadian guy Rickler, and that stars Paul Giamatti. Also, I haven't seen that because I have that gift.
What now? Let me ask you something. I mean, I know there are a lot of films at the Toronto Film Festival, but how is it out of 30 films you haven't seen any of the ones that people are writing or talking about?
Well, I saw part of Super. I've seen The Illusionist, which is definitely one of the best reviewed movies. I saw Monsters, which was a movie that also had a lot of attention for it. It's a sort of a District 9 type movie, a very cleverly done sci-fi film on a low budget that a lot of people have enjoyed, and I've seen Three, the Tom Teichfer film, which is a German film about a threesome, which is a lot of fun. Submarine is getting a lot of nice reviews. That's a coming-of-age tale. I read the book for that one just to prepare, and that was a promising debut. So I've seen Potiche, the Francois Ozon film, which is a remake of a 70s comedy starring Catherine Deneuve, was quite charming, and I was really happy to see. I saw Dustin Lance Black's film. He's the Oscar-winning screenwriter of Milk. I saw his film, What's Wrong with Virginia? It just happened to be dreadful. You know, I saw Brighton Beach, a remake I was really looking forward to with Helen Mirren and the guy who starred in Control, the Joy Division film, and that was disappointing. A lot of people like Beginners, which is a small film starring Ewan McGregor and Christopher Plummer. It's about Christopher Plummer, who's like in his late 70s when he comes out, and his son Ewan deals with that, and then he deals with the aftermath when this guy dies of, you know, at 78 years old and tries to get over the pain and start on with his life again. I thought it was pretty good, and a lot of people found it charming. So there have been a lot of movies. I saw Let Me In, the remake of Let the Right One In. That was certainly a movie a lot of people were anticipating.
They're saying that's one of the best horror films to be made in quite some time.
Well, they're insane. The original is one of the best horror films to be made in quite some time. I still don't see the reason for the remake. Some people have liked it and given it to me. The more similar it is to the original, the more reason I don't see why they remade it. Other than box office, but it's certainly not a Hollywoodization of that story. So any fans of the original shouldn't get too upset. It's very somber. It's very serious. It's very true to the plot of the original film, which is really a great, terrific film. And it's respect.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us what it's about?
Well, Let the Right One In is about vampires. It's about a little boy who's lonely, who gets picked on at school, and a little girl moves in next door, but she tells him right away, I can't be your friend. He has no friends, so it's a little bit of a bummer to hear. And slowly we realize that she's a vampire and she has a handler, a man who goes out and gets bodies for her so she can feed. And it's just, but it's not a violent horror film. It's more moody and unnerving because it's real. You know, it's sort of like your next door neighbor's a vampire. It's not some crazy flashy vampire flick. It's a real film in which one of the characters happens to be a vampire. And she says, he asks her how old she is. I'm 11 years old, but I've been 11 for a really long time.
Well, now,
and the original really is a classic, a modern masterpiece. And this one is very similar to it. I say the big difference is that this one has a more obvious, heavy-handed score, and that doesn't help it. It's more of a da-da kind of score, which sort of pushes the horror aspect of it. And but I was surprised when I saw some of the good reviews. I thought everyone would dislike it, but there you go.
Well, now you were right, Michael. Super, which was directed by James Gunn and stars Rainn Wilson, it was picked up by IFC Films, and of course, Ted Hope, friend of the show, he produced that film.
Yeah, and some of the other high-profile films I saw were Never Let Me Go, a film based on the Kazuo Ishiguro novel that Time magazine called The Book of the Decade, and that is a big young cast with Carey Mulligan, Keira Knightley, and Andrew Garfield, our future Spider-Man, and I didn't like that either. Nobody.
Why not?
This is the one by Mark Romanek.
That's right. It's I'm not a big fan of the book either. I thought the book was pretty good, but I'm not a huge fan of it. And this wasn't even nearly as good as the book. It was just very muted and uninvolving. You know, it's a film with a very high concept. Yeah, it's definitely boring. It's a high concept film about young people in an alternate time of America who are raised to donate organs to other people. They know they're going to die in their 20s because the only purpose of them living, they're clones who are brought up simply to donate organs so other people can live longer. And it's such a weird high concept thing, and yet it almost never comes into play in the film. It's sort of like over to the side. So it's a very sort of mundane film about this weird topic, and it just never gets involving. It's just emotionally inert, unfortunately.
Well, now, how come you haven't seen The King's Speech or 127 Hours? Have you been shut out? Were those films screening at a time where there was a conflict?
Well, I arrived late on the first day. That's why I missed The King's Speech, which only had one critic screening. 127 Hours was the big fiasco of the festival. Toronto's known as a very press-friendly festival. It's very easy, very casual. You don't feel a lot of stress. You can almost always get into your screenings. But they had a problem with a public screening, and they had to move its venue from one place to the screening room where we were going to watch 127 Hours. So that meant everybody waiting in line to see this movie, which was the big film of the day to see, and there were 500-600 people waiting in line. Suddenly, we weren't allowed in. They brought in people from across the street to go into our screening room. Nobody knew what was going on or why. It took them.
Oh, wait a second. I read about this.
Yeah. You never want to screw up when you've got a room full of journalists around. You know, like if your plane is on the tarmac for 5 hours, you really don't want it to be filled with journalists heading to a convention, because everybody was like, what's going on? Taking notes and ready to write about the outrage of them having to wait in line.
Not even journalists. Anybody who's got a Twitter account, you don't want them on.
Exactly. That's true. So people were delayed for 2 hours before they. Venue half the size, so half the people didn't get in. I was literally in line for 2 hours and ended up being five people away when they cut off the line. I was like, no! So I wasted literally 3 hours of my time. I left another film early to get in line for this film and ended up not seeing it. And then they had a remake, a makeup screen, but which is at a very inconvenient time. And so only like eight people showed up for that because it was just not a good time. It was that day at five when people had a lot of other movies to see. And, you know, it always happens like that. There's always three movies playing at the same time that you really want to see. Every morning they have that. Toronto needs to step up its game as far as repeat screenings of the big films. They don't have a lot of that. And they don't have a lot of late night screenings. They sort of stop the private press screenings by about 7 o'clock typically for almost every movie. And because they switch to public screenings at the same venue. And they need to have some more 8, 9, and 10 p.m. screenings to handle overflow and just give people options to be able to see all the movies they need to see.
Wow, well, it sounds like you've been quite busy, so busy, in fact, that I'm sure you haven't seen the MTV Video Music Awards.
No, but I did read that it was their highest-rated VMA since 2002. Was it 11.8 million people? How many people saw it?
Well, 11 million viewers, and MTV said that 12 to 34-year-old audience was up 33% from 2009. And, of course, 2009 had that wonderful little episode where as Taylor Swift was accepting her award, the country music, young country music star, she was accepting an award and Kanye West jumped on stage and decided to take the microphone and steal her spotlight and was kind of ridiculed for that.
They should have invited him back this year and given him a front row seat.
I think they did, actually.
I think they did, yeah.
I mean, he performed and came out to booze and everybody was cheering by the time he left. So I read.
And he had been, like, on his Twitter account and, like, for, like, 2 hours talking about how sorry he was. Essentially, the guy's got an album to promote and he wants people to like him again.
Yeah, I heard that Kanye West has been kind of, like, going through a psychological breakdown.
Or a what do you mean you heard that?
On Twitter. That's gross.
All you have to do is pay attention to what's going on around you, and you can tell the guy's having a breakdown.
Why is that? Was he not? What's he doing?
Well, first of all, he's always kind of been kind of an a-hole.
Yeah, he's a jerk.
Sorry.
Yeah, he's a jerk, yeah.
I don't think he responded very well to the public's vehemence against him with the Taylor Swift thing. I think he thought he was so arrogant. I think he thought he could get away with it. And when everybody turned against him, I think that was a big eye-opener for him. And from what I gather, he hasn't been quite the same since, but I don't really follow that kind of news, so I don't really know.
But it was a big event, I mean, or a big build-up, because Taylor Swift was going to be there, Kanye West was going to be there. Taylor Swift sang a song, and in the song kind of the lyrics refer to the event and refer to Kanye West, and she forgives him.
Of course.
Well, yeah, good for her. I mean, but the big news of the night, from what I gather, because no, I didn't watch it. I'm way too old for this kind of stuff now, is that Lady Gaga won so many awards and that she came wearing a dress made of meat.
Well, she came wearing about 300 dresses. That's the whole point. Every time she got up on stage, she won 8 awards. Every time she got up on stage, she had another outfit on. The last one was made completely of meat. Including the shoes, I might add. It looks absolutely incredible, and I don't mean that in a either good or bad way. It's just remarkable that somebody was able to make that.
Like raw meat?
Raw meat. And, in fact, Cher gave out the last award, and she asked Cher to hold her meat purse.
Ew.
Well,
wait a second. That could have been taken many, many ways, and what I meant by that
or
is...
Or not until you said that. I wasn't going there at all. Good Lord. But she's definitely... She's definitely an artist who whose fashion is just as important as her music. And I'm not disparaging her music in that way, but she works with top designers from all over the world. She always wears new outfits every concert, every performance. It's a big thing for her. So good for her. I thought the other big news was Chelsea Handler, the host, who I saw got panned, got a lot of bad reviews.
Yeah, I was gratified to see that. But, you know, she kind of got the last laugh because they did really well in ratings. So.
Absolutely. And she had a fun bit with the Jersey Shore cast where they were all in a hot tub wearing a fake pregnancy belly. You know, because you get knocked up. When you're with the situation, you end up in a situation.
What a weird choice, though, to host the VMAs. I mean, I don't think anybody who actually watches the VMAs knows who she is. Do they?
She must have a young following.
But she's so – oh, this is terrible. She's so old. She's like in her 40s.
Well, she traded rehab gags with Lindsay Lohan and started talking smack about Mel Gibson and young Justin Bieber, who won the Best New Artist Award. And of course,
this is why people showed up, by the way. It's because Lady Gaga was going to be there and Bieber and Kanye West. And that's why people watch this. No one cares about Chelsea Handler.
Absolutely. That's how all award shows work.
Does anybody care about Howard Stern?
Yes, I found that fascinating.
Well, Howard Stern, for those of you outside the country and who may not know, he is a shock jock radio personality here in the United States, and he made big news a couple years back when he went from terrestrial radio. Yeah, he was on the radio, and he was syndicated all over the country, and he decided because the FCC was coming down pretty hard on him because his language was, well, it was somewhat profane, he decided to go onto satellite radio, and he was paid $500 million to sign a contract with Sirius.
That might have been another reason, the half a billion dollar package that he got.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's more that.
And now he's announced that he's not sure whether he'll stick with satellite radio, but I think it seems more like a negotiating ploy. I don't think there's anywhere for him to go. I think he's set up there. He may want to scale back his hours a little bit because he has like 3 channels that he programs, plus his show that he hosts every day. Maybe he's looking to lighten his workload a tad, but they're going to... He's very, very important to them, and they're very important to him, frankly. But I'll tell you, Sirius and XM have merged since he joined satellite radio, and it's picking up some steam and doing quite well. So they need him, they want him, and he wants them. You know, he wants to be part of that. So I don't think he's going anywhere.
He could always have a podcast.
Well, no, he talked about that.
Don't say that. It might come true.
No, it's true. Well,
more competition.
I'm sure he has a podcast now that he makes available in some way. But like Dr. Laura, he has also talked about just going it alone. Why not just sit in his home and record the show and put it out on a podcast and charge people that way? There's a lot of things you can do now on your own without needing a big corporation behind you. And that's certainly a possibility. But I still think he's invested too much in satellite radio and in his position there, which is pretty ideal to bother changing it. Why not? It's just easier. Why bother? She has a reason to do it. I don't think he needs to.
Well, should we bother saying who won some of the MTV Video Music Awards, or does anybody care?
It was all no, Lady Gaga. It was Lady Gaga's night. We already did. She won everything in sight. She and Justin Bieber.
Well, Eminem won a couple of awards. Best Male Video and Best Hip Hop Video.
Well, he's definitely made a comeback. You know, his comeback album, Rehab, was it Relapse or Rehab? Which came first? The chicken or the egg? He had a comeback album, which got pretty mixed reviews. It was not great, and he immediately disowned it and said, I wasn't really on my game. I wasn't fully recovered yet. And his new album has gotten much better reviews. He's going to be performing at a Yankee Stadium with Jay-Z. They're touring together. So he's definitely, you know, fierce and hungry and ready to be back on top of his game, which is great to see because he's one of the great rappers around.
Well, his album certainly is selling unbelievably well.
Well, for this day and age, it's like a double platinum or something like that. And, you know, in the past, he might have sold 8 or 10 million copies. But, yeah, it's selling well.
Well, then, if you're not interested in going over the winners of the MTV Video Music Awards because you don't think it's a big deal, then maybe we should move on.
Yeah. Let's choose our own winners. Big deal, big whoop.
Yes, I was segueing into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. We haven't really prepared anything for this week, so we're just going to fly by the seat of our pants. And our first story, Michael, is about somebody you might be running into there in Toronto, Roger Ebert.
I haven't seen him here yet. I assume you will know if he's here if you follow him on Twitter or whatever. Yeah, he is here, of course. He did a panel discussion. I haven't seen him.
Wait a second. He didn't do a panel discussion. He must have...
He did. It was on Twitter. It was people twittering on a topic and having a certain amount of time to write their tweet, and then the audience voted on which was the best tweet. He's joked that he was going to turn it into a game show. So he's here. He obviously wasn't talking regularly at the panel discussion, but it was an idea he came up with and hosted, and it sounded like a lot of fun.
Well, he is going to be relaunching At the Movies, the movie review show that launched his career, along with Gene Siskel, of course. They premiered it on, I guess it was PBS back in the 1970s, I believe.
Well, I'm sure no, it was a local, I'm pretty sure it was a local Chicago station at first.
Well, either way, Buena Vista, the Disney television production company, decided not to continue production of that show after Ebert left and they had a number of different hosts. They decided not to continue the show, and he's bringing it back on his own, along with his wife, Chaz.
And it will be on television?
It'll be on PBS, actually. It's returning to its roots. When I said it was a local Chicago, I meant a local Chicago PBS station. So they're going right back to where they started. They considered doing stuff online or cable, but they decided that PBS gave them the best atmosphere to try and have intelligent discussion of films again. One of the co-hosts is Elvis Mitchell, formerly with the New York Times. And the other one is?
Christy Lemire of the Associated Press.
Oh, well, there you go. Christy Lemire, I should say. Lemire. Sounds like Lumiere, the inventors of cinema. Christy and Elvis Mitchell, formerly from the New York Times. So those are the two hosts. Roger will appear sometimes on screen. And it's I think it's a big deal. It's a venerable brand, and there's certainly room for intelligent discussion of film on television, which there isn't a lot of. It's usually box office like we do. So there you go. I say it's a big deal.
Karen?
I agree. It's a big deal. I'm curious that it's going to be on television and not on, listen to me, television. Why is it going to be on TV and not online? That strikes me as really old-fashioned and kind of interesting.
Well, really, after spending the entire week at IBC, I can tell you that the two are merging.
And that's news?
Right, I'm sure they'll have an online presence. But, you know, PBS can reach, they can get a national audience via PBS much easier than syndicated or even a cable channel.
You're right. I'm so used to hearing, you know, people saying, and we're going to debut it online, that somebody saying it's going to be on, you know, TV. I'm like, oh, that's so quaint.
Well, now, bloggers Kim Morgan and Omar Moore will also be contributing to the program. I'm not quite sure how, but we'll place a link to the news in the show notes. Well, our next story is about a band that I saw. It's The XX, and it's kind of a three-person band. I believe they're from England, and they won the Mercury Prize. Do you even know what the Mercury Prize is?
Oh, absolutely. It's a big deal for me. Mercury Prize is a very prestigious award. It's like winning Grammy for Album of the Year. It can often bring young bands to huge new attention. It spurs album sales. It's like the British Booker, which is their book prize. It's very prestigious. and it gives you a real goose in sales. So it's definitely a big deal that they won, and I like their album a lot. It was one of my favorites of last year, so I'm thrilled to see it.
Well, and I turned to Karen and asked her whether she thought it was a big deal or a big whoop, but I know she had to step away for a moment, so hopefully we'll get her back before Inside Baseball. I saw the XX...
Come back, little Sheba. Come back, little Sheba.
Sorry. She can't hear you. I saw the XX perform at Coachella, and I was underwhelmed, although maybe it was the wrong venue, maybe it was the wrong time, maybe it was the wrong setting, because everybody who sees them falls in love with them. Their album's pretty good, but I was not a big fan of their live performance.
Oh, well. The next item, let me turn the tables on you since we lost Karen and see if you think something's a big deal or a big whoop. Simon Cowell is launching the X Factor next fall, but that's putting into a spanner in the works of his UK shows, the X Factor and Britain's Got Talent, which are two huge moneymakers and two of the biggest shows on television in that country. So he's literally turning his back on two huge hits in the UK to launch the X Factor in the US, and that's really screwing up their network. Sperling, do you think that's a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal for the UK and for those networks in the UK, but I think, it's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you how important the U.S. market is and how that can just drive the entire world, and you can make so much money from it that, you know, the UK becomes a small pond, frankly.
Well, our next story is about the Kindle, the Amazon Kindle, which is an e-reader, and it looks like Best Buy is going to be carrying it. So far, it's the only physical retailer to see Kindles, Nooks, and Sony e-readers all at the same time. And I guess if you want to compare them, maybe you can convince a friend to bring along an iPad, and you'd have like all four or five of these things. Michael, is this a big deal?
It is a big deal. I don't think a day goes by when I don't hear somebody talking about e-books. I have a friend ask me which one they should buy or telling me how much they love their e-reader. This is coming a lot faster than I expected.
Our final big deal or big whoop is about Oprah's Victory Lap, which is actually turning into a sad fade-out. Her talk show was barely in the top 10 of syndicated shows, ranking 9th, well down from its peak years ago, like all syndicated shows. Wheel of Fortune got a 5.8 rating. Jeopardy's got a 4.9. Two and a Half Men is a 4.3. Judge Judy is down, 4.2. Entertainment Tonight and CSI New York are at 3.4. And these are the ratings, the Nielsen ratings in the United States. Everybody loves, I mean, I could go on and on. Everybody's down. Michael, is big deal or big whoop?
Well, everybody's down, but Oprah's ratings are down. And instead of being number one in a press market, she's number 9. She's below reruns of Everybody Loves Raymond and Family Guy. This is a big deal. It's a little sad. It's the end of an era. I mean, not only is her show saying goodbye, it's saying goodbye as a shadow of its former self. So she definitely, she may have even stayed 1 year too late, but she definitely made the right decision. And that is officially the end of the saddest, smallest, big deal, big whoop ever.
That is the end of the saddest, smallest, big deal, or big whoop ever. But hey, we're traveling. Bear with us. You know what we should do is maybe let's try and get Karen back on the line.
I miss her.
We have a special guest, Megan Garvey from the Los Angeles Times. He's going to join us. You know what? I'll just record. Yeah, okay. You said smallest, saddest?
The smallest, saddest, big deal, big whoop ever.
Well, yes, that is the saddest, smallest, big deal, or big whoop ever. And hopefully next week we'll actually have some time, despite the fact that we'll still be in three different time zones. Hopefully we'll have more stories to talk about, but now it's time for Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the news stories that only Hollywood might care about. And indeed, this week, our first story people in Hollywood will care about, and I'll just cut it somewhere there.
Great. Sorry about all this. It's going to be a pain for you to edit.
You know what? I knew that going in.
Yeah. I'll be able to write copy next week. I apologize for that.
Not a problem.
All right. Well, have a lot of fun if you can.
Thank you. You too. Try to see some of those movies.
I will. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, a little later on in the show, we're going to be joined by Megan Garvey from the Los Angeles Times, who's going to tell us about a new iPod application. A little later on, we're going to be joined by Megan Garvey from the Los Angeles Times. He's going to fill us in on the new iPhone application that the Times has put together for the Hollywood Walk of Fame. We're also, of course, going to be talking about the Toronto Film Festival, since, Michael, you're there. And we're also going to talk about the MTV Video Music Awards. Unfortunately, we don't have that many big... Unfortunately, we don't have that many big deal or big whoop stories to talk about this week because we've all been traveling, or at least Michael and I have. But bear with us. We have a few that we can go over. And we're going to wind up talking again to Megan Garvey, but also we're going to be talking about The Hollywood Reporter and their announcement that they will be switching formats from a daily trade publication to a weekly glossy magazine. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire, Michael Giltz, who is going to fill us in on the weekend's box office. Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And our first Inside Baseball topic of this week is really something that people only inside Hollywood might care about, although if you're visiting Hollywood, you really should care about it. Megan Garvey, the senior assistant editor of the California section at the Los Angeles Times, is joining us to talk about the LA Times new iPod and, I guess, iPhone and iPad app, which is a Hollywood Walk of Fame app where as you're walking down the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Hollywood Boulevard, you can actually read about the stars and it's got augmented reality built into it. Megan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I can tell you I'm at IBC right now in Amsterdam, and I can tell you augmented reality is a huge topic here. Do you want to explain what the application does?
It happens to be the 50th anniversary of the Walk of Fame when the first stars went in on the Walk of Fame. I think some people think it's even older than that, but it was part of this revitalization effort by Hollywood to sort of regain the glamour, which even in 1960 had faded quite a bit. So you have now more than 2,400 physical Terrazzo stars on the sidewalks of the Walk of Fame, and it's an iconic symbol of Los Angeles. People who come to Los Angeles go there. It's one of the single biggest tourism attractions in all of the Southern California area. But a lot of people, when they go out there, it's sort of a disappointing experience. You're looking at squares on the sidewalk, and you're kind of like, eh. But we realized that there was so much history to the people out there, even the people that names didn't necessarily right away mean something to you. So the idea was if you could be out there and you could see easily as you walk, whose star you were on, who they were, that you could create sort of this almost like living history of Hollywood and the world of entertainment if you could tap into the archives of Los Angeles Times and mash that up with modern technology.
It's sort of like having the best tour guide in the world there to help you figure out who all these people are and what they did.
Well, we'd like to think so. I mean, we went back all the way into the 1800s in our archives to find out who people were. Some people, it was really hard. Some people, Wikipedia has, stuff, sometimes wrong stuff, but, it's out there. There were people, though, that we came across that we had to do a considerable amount of research. There are a few people that were still figure out really who they were.
Well, the Hollywood Walk of Fame is a 15-block segment of Hollywood Boulevard. It runs right past Grauman's Chinese Theater, which I believe is once again called Grauman's Chinese Theater after being called a couple of other things over the years. And it attracts something like 10 or 12 million people per year. There's more than 2,400 different stars. and they are in categories like film, television, recording, radio, and I guess theater, so the theatrical arts. And each star has a little medallion embedded into it that tells you what the star is for. So, you know, even though it's got the person's name, it might say John Wayne, but it'll have a little television there, so that's for his television work.
Some people have more than one star. People who were prominent in more than one field. I mean, the most famous is Gene Autry, because he's the only one that has all five stars.
There are a couple fictitious characters that have a star as well. I believe Bugs Bunny being one of them.
To me, one of the most interesting is Strongheart. Have you guys ever heard of Strongheart?
No.
No.
I had never heard of Strongheart. I'm like, who is Strongheart? You know, some sort of silent, you know, romantic leading man. But Strongheart turns out to be sort of the first famous dog actor. And Strongheart was born in Germany, was like a trained German war dog who came to Hollywood and was a huge star in the 1920s and I think early 30s. And, you know, we found this hilarious clip from the 20s that, you know, Bill Strongheart is the only star not to have been divorced, arrested for, you know, DUI or, you know, bankrupt. And they had a picture of him in a open Cadillac. So, I mean, I didn't know who Strongheart was, but Strongheart turned out to be pretty significant in the history of films in terms of making animals into stars.
But, you know, Megan, I don't know if that's accurate because I believe he was arrested once for public urination.
You might have been. You're right about that.
I have to say, I've played with this app online. They had some stuff available, and it was really, really fun. I'm wondering what the LA Times' desire was. Do you offer for free, or do you charge? Will there be ads embedded in the app, which would be fine and great, because I think it's a really worthwhile thing, or is it just to keep the LA Times presence there for tourists coming to town?
Right. Well, we have two versions of it. One is the mobile app, and we are charging for that. I believe it's $2.99. But if you're anywhere in the world, you can also just sign on to latimes.com/Hollywood, and we have a desktop version of it that we sort of see as a virtual tour. So even if you are, say, in Singapore, you could sign on and in a lot of ways get the experience of being on the Walk of Fame. We have actual pictures of each star, and you can choose different ways to go in. You can look at people by sort of category, how they're related to each other. I mean, if you're interested in Lucille Ball, you might be interested in the other people in I Love Lucy or other people that she was connected to, like John Wayne was a frequent co-star of hers. We've grouped people together like that as well. So there's sort of two main ways to see this. One is mobile out there, you know, on the Walk of Fame or anywhere in the world, really. We'll tell you how far away you are from whatever star it is that you're interested in looking at. And then the other is the desktop version, which really gives you a virtual tour. We had someone write us in from, I think it was Michigan, saying, you know, she was older, she loved Hollywood. The reality was she was really never going to make it to L.A., but now she felt like she had sort of seen the Walk of Fame, and she planned to, like, stay on it, come back to it, and learn more over time.
Well, everyone from Lassie to Thomas Edison to Godzilla is represented on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and I'm wondering, is there a reason you decided to charge for the application rather than give it away? I know a lot of work went into it, but is this a new revenue model for the Los Angeles Times?
I think the idea was that we had our news app, and then we're trying to think of ways to be creative, right? You know, what do we have that other people don't have? And we felt that we had a lot of history, and we had done a lot of manual labor. And, yeah, I mean, I think the hope is this is something that would resonate with people, and it would be worthwhile to people. If we made money on it, I mean, honestly, that'd be great, you know, because, as everyone knows, newspapers and are struggling and trying to find new ways to make money, and we felt this was a way that fit into our overall editorial purpose. You know, it's just like we charge people for subscription to the paper. You know, it's really no different from that.
I think it's a very smart use of your archives, and I think people should do a better job with their archives online in general as far as trying to present things in a more encyclopedic way that you can access them more easily. Has doing this app brought up any ideas for other apps you guys might explore in the future?
You know, we've talked about doing some apps off of things that already exist. I oversee a lot of our interactive projects, and that's sort of a natural, like, world to look at for these types of apps. And the editor on the Homicide Report, I mean, you could see an app that would tell you, you know, how close you are to homicide.
Ouija.
Cool.
I mean, a little ghoulish, yes. But we are, later this month, coming out with a very innovative new crime site called Crime LA that you could see people wanting to have on a mobile application that will update daily to make you more aware. You know, you could see doing, and we do have some of this already in Star Walk, but you could see, like, you know, the most famous crimes, for example, would be sort of a natural thing for the LA Times to do. You know, you go through and you find sort of the most infamous murders or the most infamous, you know, whatever. I mean, the archives is so rich. It's amazing when you delve into them, you know, sort of the fluctuating quality of the LA Times over the years, too. So
this sounds so great to me. I mean, I'm so happy to know that I'm not the only person who's obsessed with this kind of thing.
Well, you're definitely not, and certainly I speak for myself, but I'm really looking forward to seeing what else the Los Angeles Times has when it comes to these types of applications. Megan, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it was really fun, guys. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Megan. You know, I have to say that it's a smart use of their archives. It's a lot of fun. I've played with it online, and I think a lot of other newspapers should look at their archives and say, what can we do about local history? There isn't a town in this country that doesn't have local history and that they couldn't use their archives to prevent guided tours of their town and just get their name out there. And, you know, even if they give it away for free, it helps extend their brand. And it's a really smart use.
You guys have no idea how excited I am to look at this.
Well, it's funny you should mention about giving it away for free, because that's what The Hollywood Reporter has been doing on their website for quite some time. And just yesterday, Monday, they announced that they would be going to a weekly publication.
Well, I think this is long overdue. I don't know why Variety publishes Daily Variety. With the internet, the breaking news just comes online. There's no need to print a paper every day. It's a silly thing for the industry. But there is a use, I think, still perhaps for a weekly issue that collects reviews and charts and things and presents it in a more thorough or, you know, in-depth analysis. But for daily breaking news, there's a Daily Hollywood Reporter is a waste of money. So I think it's the right thing to do.
Well, because they're going to stay online, right? And they're going to have dollar breaking news. It's going to be online. Now, I see this weekly is almost a competitor to Entertainment Weekly.
Right. I mean, the New York Times had a great article about what they're doing to the paper. And Janice Min, of course, we've talked about her before. We've invited her on the show, and hopefully she'll join us soon and can tell us all about what's going on at The Hollywood Reporter and what her plans are for the publication. They're going to be releasing a daily PDF and then breaking news online. And quite honestly, I've been walking around IBC. There's 13, 14 different halls, huge halls, and I must have seen at least 1,000 iPads. And there's a lot of talk about why IBC this year had a daily newspaper. They have it every year. It's an interesting read. But why is it still on paper and not just electronic? People are, you know, they have their iPads with them. They could just flip through it electronically.
Well, more to the point, for Hollywood Reporter, it's just by the time it lands on your desk in the morning, it's going to be outdated by 10 a.m. So it just doesn't work anymore.
I really wonder how Variety is going to respond to this.
Well, I don't, it might make Daily Variety a little more valuable to some people, I guess, since Hollywood Reporter won't offer a competitor. But I think they should scrap Daily Variety. It's gotten thinner and thinner every day. And now Hollywood Reporter won't be a competitor for weekly news because they're going to go in a more mainstream edition. So I think this gives Variety a little sign of life. You know, they can be the only weekly industries-geared newspaper, you know, or magazine, whatever you want to call it.
The Hollywood Reporter is traditionally a trade paper, and they have redesigned it into a weekly glossy magazine. According to the New York Times, they had an article, the headline of which is Hollywood Reporter to become a weekly magazine. But the first paragraph I thought was particularly harsh. The Hollywood Reporter has been dying a slow death for a decade, bleeding from layoffs, vanishing advertisers, and diminished relevance in a news cycle now dominated by cutthroat entertainment blogs. While true, the way they said it kind of made it seem like, I don't know, it's just very, very harsh.
It's true of the entire newspaper and magazine industry, frankly.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's why I thought it was particularly harsh.
You know, I can't wait to check it out, but it'll be fascinating to see. But trying to compete with People and Us Weekly, that's not going to be easy. But Janice Min is smart, and it'll be fascinating to see what she's going to do and how she's going to keep the smarts and the industry perspective of The Hollywood Reporter and turn that to her advantage in putting out a general interest magazine.
I would love to see where it goes from here. I mean, it's a shame that it's not going to be solely trade-oriented, but as she's pointing out in the New York Times and speaking to the New York Times, you know, the trades had been the lackeys of the studios for years and kind of were hand-fed what they were supposed to publish. And so she came in and said, no, that's it. Richard Beckman, who has joined her at The Hollywood Reporter for E5, what is the name of the E5 Global Media is the group that bought The Hollywood Reporter, I believe, last year. He wants to turn it into a B2I magazine, not a B2B. So B2B stands for business to business. He would like it to be business to influencers. He's going after the influencers of the world. We'll see whether he's successful or not, but we were successful somehow in recording this week's episode, despite being in three time zones. So thank you very much for putting up with us and for bearing with us. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. You can find links to those on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Our website is also where you will find links to all of the stories that we discussed on today's episode. Again, that's showbizsandbox.com. Feel free to email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, besides in Toronto, on michaelgiltz.com, his website where he posts links to all of his writing. He can also be found on Twitter. At Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward is on Twitter. Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. Her website is karenwoodwardonline.com. You can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. And I'm on Twitter. At Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.